Hey, folks. Welcome to Heartline. I'm Rita Schulte, a licensed therapist in the Northern Virginia, D.C. area, and I'm passionate about matters of the heart. So the idea behind the podcast is simple. I want to check the pulse on your heart by taking a look at some of the cutting-edge issues that are affecting you and the people around you, and have you consider, how in the world is all this mess called life affecting your heart? To help stir things up, we're going to be talking to some of the leading professionals in the Christian counseling and literary industry, as well as hosting discussions with real people who are struggling with real life issues. If you want to know a little bit about me, check me out at siftedaswheat.com, where you can ask questions, find out about my book, listen to other podcasts, or request to be a guest on the show. You can also find me on Facebook at Rita Schulte LPC, or follow me on Twitter at Heartline Pod. So let's get going on this journey of the heart. On our next few shows, we're going to be checking the pulse on a very difficult topic, suffering. A lot of people ask me as a counselor, don't you get tired of listening to other people's problems all day? Isn't it depressing? The answer is no. This is real stuff for real life. And because I listen to people's problems, or as I like to put it, I enter into their stories, I know a lot of people are out there struggling and suffering, and they're trying to make sense of life, God, and the world around them. And that's what we're going to talk about today, how to make sense of suffering. Preparing for our topic today led me to start thinking about last year when I got the flu. I never get a flu shot, and I haven't had the flu in 15 years, but boy, did I get sick last spring. Just so happens, I was writing the chapter in my book on suffering when that occurred. For 12 days, I suffered with fever, chills, and every bodily ache and pain imaginable. That temporary loss of health made me notice several things about suffering. The first of which was my pain made me take my focus off the things of the world. It reminded me to set my affections on the things above, not on the things of the earth. It made me more other-focused, and it revealed what I really valued. During my sickness, I became increasingly aware that I wasn't worried about my work, how I looked, or not washing my hair for 12 days, or even whether or not I'd get cellulite because I hadn't worked out. All I kept thinking about was how lots of people have to suffer like this every day of their lives. And I had to ask myself, what the heck keeps them going? Mine's a lighthearted story, but suffering isn't a lighthearted manner. And to help us make sense of it, I've invited Dr. John Thomas to talk with us today about suffering. He's co-authored a book about it called What's Good About Feeling Bad? Finding a Purpose and a Path Through Suffering, released by Tyndale. Dr. Thomas is an associate professor in the Center for Counseling and Family Studies at Liberty University in Lynchburg, Virginia. He served as both chair of the department and PhD program director. He holds a Doctor of Philosophy degree in counseling and graduate certificate in alcohol and drug studies from the University of South Carolina. He received his master's degree in counseling and Bachelor of Science from Liberty University. Dr. Thomas also holds a PhD in organizational psychology from Capella University. Dr. Thomas, welcome to Heartline.
Thank you, Rita. It's a real privilege and honor to be part of your program.
Thank you. Well, we've been talking about suffering here, and I wanted to know what got you interested in this topic.
Well, it is somewhat of a morose, macabre kind of a topic, I guess, to be interested in. I guess when I was a young Christian, the book I liked to avoid the most in the Bible was Job. like a lot of people do. But actually, when I started getting an interest in counseling, as well as following just some recognition of some of the suffering that I had been through, some of which I never really had identified, another was a broken engagement, but all that kind of coalesced together to lead me to start studying the book of Job and then the Bible as far as the more broader theology on what God has to say about suffering, because it seemed like, why would he let bad things happen to such wonderful children? It never made sense to me when I was real young.
Yeah. Well, Psalm 73 is a good example of that dilemma many of us face when we address that topic. The psalmist is perplexed about the apparent prosperity of the wicked while the good suffer, and he's trying to bring congruence to God as loving, juxtaposed to being powerful and able to thwart evil, yet allowing his creatures to suffer. So if God is loving, how can he allow bad things, which would mean he's powerless to do anything about it? So what are your thoughts on that?
Well, that is probably one of the biggest obstacles to people sometimes coming to Christ, and even sometimes the reason people leave Christianity is when they encounter a level of suffering that they never dreamed they could possibly experience. They give up on their faith. I remember many years ago there was a tragic accident in France, and 50 kids were killed, and George Orwell, who said, if there was a God, I would spit in his face for, you know, how he allowed these children to endure such suffering. But I love what C.S. Lewis said, if we believe that a loving God cannot allow suffering, we have to trivialize the meaning of the word love. Hmm. No parent in the world would, you know, that wants to do a good job with raising their children would allow their children to go without experiencing the hardships of life and even certainly disciplining them when they're necessary. But, you know, children learn from trial and error. And God knows that we learn that way too. And one of the things Dr. Habermas and I used to talk a lot, he was my co-author on the book and actually was one of my professors. He used to say that, you know, if we think we don't deserve suffering, then we really think we deserve it better than Jesus Christ had it.
Wow.
Because God allowed his own son to experience horrific suffering, and who had done absolutely nothing wrong, was completely innocent and pure, and even turned his back on his son. And so God succumbed to his own suffering if he did create it and did allow it, and certainly he allowed it in his son Christ.
Yeah, absolutely. I think when we go through trials or suffering, it's normal for us to ask the why question.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes our questions don't have any answers. So what do we do with that? How do we help people through that?
Well, you know, part of our human nature, Rita, is that we love filling in blanks as humans. And we do it, as, you know, when we're kids. If you've ever had anybody on there talking about, you know, parental conflict and kids, you know, they've talked about how when children see problems going on, they fill in the blanks with, well, it's got to have something to do with me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we want to know cause and effect. And so when we go through some suffering, our natural question is to ask why, and that was the very heart of the book of Job. You know, he asked why and why this and why are you allowing me to suffer when I know I didn't sin, which is what they believed in that day, is if you suffered, you sinned. And
yeah.
Yet at the end of the book of Job, chapter 42, God never, ever says, well, Job, let me fill you in on chapters 1 and 2 in this book that you're going to have one day. He just simply meets with Job and talks to Job, and Job's response is, I spoke about things I didn't know, you know. I'd heard about you, God, but now I know you. And it was never, God, I deserve an answer anymore. It's simply meeting with God, knowing God, being transformed by God was enough to make asking why just so unimportant.
Yeah.
But it takes a lot to get there, and, you know, it's really a death of our will. For God to get us to the point where he's all that matters.
Mm, it's surrendering ourselves. It's coming to a point of acceptance of the sovereignty of God and a trust that even though the bottom's dropped out in my life, God, you're still good. You still got my back.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things Dr. Habermas shared when his wife died many years ago, at the age of 43, she was diagnosed with cancer, and within less than 2 months, she was dead. You know, his biggest apologetic background was the resurrection, and he kept saying, God, why? You know, why are you allowing my wife with our young kids to die? And he said God just kept telling him, do you believe I can raise the dead? You know, do you believe I can raise the dead? And it was like, God, you know, I wrote the book on it, you know. of course I do, but really what he said God was trying to get through to him is, if you can believe I can do anything and I'm good, then you don't really need to ask anymore. And his wife, Debbie, had already come to grips with it and was worshiping, and he said as soon his heart became one of worship, too. You know, I could imagine losing my spouse, but, you know, the point is, whatever we go through, no matter how horrific, we can meet God in it.
Oh, you're absolutely right.
That's the beautiful thing of it.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Because I think even in our pain, I mean, even with Job, he lamented before God. He was angry at God. He cried out to God. He wrestled with God in the midst of his suffering. And I think that connects us with the heart of God, even in that relationship, even at our ranting and raving at him. And then our search hopefully will yield an intimacy of God revealing himself to us in the midst of our pain.
Oh, yeah. When I get to heaven, I want to spend a little time with Job and a little time with David. Because, boy, I've just been so encouraged by both of them. And, you know, Job is talking about how God set traps and, you know, sent his arrows into him. And he's going on and on and on and on. I think it's in chapter 19. And then all of a sudden, in the midst of blaming God for his awful life, he says, but I know my Redeemer lives.
Yeah.
You know, the fact that we believe in God and know his sovereignty and know he's going to take good out of bad doesn't mean that we don't hurt. It doesn't mean we don't lament. It doesn't mean that we don't struggle. You know, we have to just kind of own the fact that these are just normal human emotions, that by struggling with them, we actually build up our spiritual muscles. We shouldn't shame ourselves for questioning or, you know, emotionally you know, going out of control at times, because suffering is hard.
Sure.
It's supposed to be hard.
Yeah. I think some Christians believe that, at least I know I did at the beginning of my walk when I became a Christian, that if I gave my life to Christ, that would mean like I wouldn't have pain. Mm-hmm. That, you know, I have this insurance policy against suffering somehow. But Jesus really did tell us that in the world we will have trouble. So, I don't know, do you think Christians have this idea that a life dedicated to God means a life without pain?
I think we have such superficial understanding of God. I mean, you know, we know his ways past understanding, and yet we really want to bring him down to our level and understand him. And, you know, parents wouldn't let their children go through needless pain, and so how could God? And yet, becoming a Christian really opens you up for more suffering. You know, if I was an unbeliever, I don't have to worry about how my faith is going to get me in trouble in a college or a workplace or, Lord knows, in some places in the world where you'll be killed for it. You know, it creates struggles. I don't have to struggle with my thought life necessarily if I don't, you know, close to God, but that creates a level of suffering when I want to honor him and please him in every way, and yet, you know, I find the struggles are there. And yet God knows the value of suffering. It's priceless in his economy. It's just not something we as self-preoccupied, egocentric children want to endure.
Right.
But the sooner we can kind of set down the kind of clenched fist and let go of that and just simply say, okay, God, you know, what's the meaning of this? What are you going to do with this? We kind of can get through it a whole lot easier.
Yeah.
Fighting reality never helps.
You said in the book, all suffering has meaning.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a hard pill to swallow when suffering knocks on the door of our hearts.
Oh, yes.
Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, you know, people that kind of maybe bristle at that one are people maybe who've been sexually abused, which actually I have as well, or people that have, you know, been through just horrific kind of suffering. How can there be any meaning in this? And what's interesting is even secular counselors, psychologists, have come to recognize that trauma can transform. There's a whole kind of area of the literature that's developing called post-traumatic trauma transformation and post-trauma growth, kind of worded in different ways. But the whole point is that suffering, trauma, is a means towards some kind of growth. There's a meaning in it that takes us above and out of it and transforms it in a way. Viktor Frankl, who many maybe of the listeners are familiar with, was a psychiatrist imprisoned in a German concentration camp, lost several of his family members while in there, and talked about the fact that the ones that could find meaning in the midst of the suffering, that if there was meaning in life at all, then there had to be meaning in suffering, because suffering was part of life, that those were the ones who got through the concentration camp without losing who they were inside. It was the ones that fought the injustice and the sense of pain that went along with it that struggled because they could never make sense of it. And that just, you know, sends our mind spinning when we think we're going through something that's not only unjust and unfair, but meaningless to boot.
Yeah. I think it builds resiliency is what I'm hearing you say.
Oh, absolutely. But it's a painful way to get there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just simply God's means of strengthening our spiritual muscles and our emotional muscles and our maturity.
Well, how do we help people practically to walk through suffering? I mean, I think sometimes we're all too quick to throw out Bible verses to them when that may not be what they need to hear in the moment.
Oh, no. I know you had a dear friend of mine, Teresa Sowers, on your mm-hmm. program, and she experienced different kinds of suffering, but the death of her son when he was 6 years old. And I remember, just wasn't her therapist or anything, but just a dear friend, and walked with her through it. She told me, she said, "John, if I hear somebody quote Romans 8:28 to me one more time, no jury will hold me responsible."
Yeah.
You know, and she said, you know, it's not that I don't believe it's true. I believe it absolutely. But where people are when they're in the midst of kind of crisis or suffering or adversity, they're in their emotions. And you're not going to reach them with logical, cognitive, you know, sorts of things. You're going to reach them with your presence. You're going to reach them with your heart. You have to be Christ in the flesh for them at that moment, simply comforting and listening. Job's friends were brilliant when they spent 7 days sitting with him in silence on an ash heap. In fact, maybe Job got so honest in his talking because his friends were so supportive and caring. But it was when his friends opened their mouth that trouble began. And I just think people don't have to worry about what to say or what not to say. Just be there and look for practical ways to help. I know people cut the Sowers grass and took them meals, didn't ask. They just went and did these things. And anything they could to make life a little easier, a little less complicated. And that just meant the world to them and gave them the opportunity and space to grieve.
Yeah, just being there.
And that's the best thing we can do.
Mm-hmm. I think suffering has a tendency to change people's concept of God. They're angry, and they often come to view God as unfair, uncaring, or unmerciful. How do we help them walk that out?
You know, in the book, I mentioned three core beliefs that people go through or that have and that get kind of provoked when we suffer, and they all tie into God. You know, the world should be comfortable and easy, and when it's not, God isn't good. The world should be orderly and predictable, and when it's not, God can't be trusted. And the world should be fair, and when it's not, God isn't just. And so people kind of express those goodness of God, trustworthiness of God, and justice of God in different ways. But ultimately, the best thing to do is let them get it out. You know, God doesn't need us to defend them, and his word does a great job with it, but simply is listening. And even sometimes giving expression to things they may not say. I know I've sent to many a client, well, I'll give you one example. I had a woman whose husband died a horrific death and fairly quickly. And finally, after 6 months, I finally said, you know, God wronged you. And she goes, God can't wrong me. And I said, he wronged you. And then she burst into tears and said, you know, that's what I've been saying for this last 6-7 months since he died. I did believe he wronged me, but I know God doesn't wrong me. And that was the turning point, was just allowing her to express what her heart believed and thought was true, but her head knew it wasn't. So just allow them to express that and get it out. Don't feel like you got to defend God.
Mm-hmm. I often have people make a certificate of debt, according to Colossians 2, and put God up there. I mean, it's no surprise to God that we're angry at him. So it's
exactly.
Not catching him off guard, and then just listing the offense, listing the feelings, listing the beliefs that come out of that, and then what they had hoped or expected for from God that they didn't get, and that translates into their loss. So I think they've got to just work through that. And again, that doesn't happen overnight either.
No, I mean, I've talked to people about forgiving God, and some people get really offended at that notion, but you know, the truth is, it's not that God did us any wrong, but we believe he did, and so we have to work through it, and usually you hit the nail on the head. It's usually in the instance of kind of a ledger of offenses and wrongs that he did that we have to kind of unpack and list and account for, and then we can process it through easier, and eventually, if we do that, we come to realize he really didn't do us wrong in the first place. He actually blessed us in a very painful way.
Yeah, because our belief systems are what we're going to live out of and behave out of. And so
right.
if we have a false concept of God, or we believe God's unmerciful or unkind or whatever, then we're going to act accordingly. So that's going to keep us stuck when it comes to trusting him or surrendering or forgiving or a number of things.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think keeps some people locked in a perpetual state of suffering?
Well, there's a couple of things. I mean, number one, suffering happens to a human being, and that human being has already a life of experience and ways of dealing with pain and suffering. Those people, you know, may have had some level of trauma already, and this is just kind of on top of it all. And so, you know, you have to kind of understand, where was this person at? An analogy I use a lot with people is, you know, if you were to go home and plug a hairdryer in and the circuit blew, most of us are savvy enough to realize it wasn't the hairdryer that tripped the breaker. There was so much pulling on the breaker that the hairdryer just kind of put it over the top.
Mm-hmm.
And in people's lives, they have a lot of load that they're carrying, and we often don't know what, you know, what that is. We might know what they just went through and wonder, well, how in the world can that, you know, overwhelm them? Well, you know, you don't realize all the rest of the stuff they've got going on. And so you have to kind of begin to understand, what is this person currently dealing with? What have they dealt with? What's their level of coping? You know, are they an individual that's not very resourceful when it comes to coping? Do they not understand the Bible well? Certainly people that understand the Bible well and God, at least as good as he can, Job certainly had a good knowledge of him, but that was totally transformed to a much higher level later, you know, I think do better. So just realizing when something happens to somebody, it isn't happening to you, it's happening to them, and what are they like, what's their baseline level of functioning, and, you know, what might it take for them to get through it? And they may take a lot longer than
sure.
it would us, and that's okay.
Yeah, because there's so many layers sometimes when people are suffering or in a situation when they come to, like a counselor, for example. This may not be the first loss they've incurred or the first assault on their heart. Perhaps they've gone through life not noticing or paying attention to the other more abstract losses of life, shattered dreams, mm-hmm. loss of hope, loss of identity, role loss, any of that. That all layer upon layer adds up until, well, like you said, one little other thing happens and then, boom, the bottom drops out.
Yeah. And there's some things that are just universally difficult, losing a child.
Yes,
you know,
absolutely.
For example, is one that I think we can all relate to. No parent ever wants to have to go through that. And so, you know, there are just some things that are going to take years and years to get through, even at our best.
Absolutely.
So understanding the level of the trauma is important.
In the book, you describe that suffering works in four directions in the life of a sufferer. Can you talk about those for a minute?
Sure. Basically, when I was back in college, I kind of mentioned earlier, I kind of really started studying this, and I started realizing there was a lot of different reasons God seemed to allow suffering to occur. And when I kind of started listening to passages and writing them down, I started looking at them and noticing, you know, there's kind of some themes here that seem to be occurring. And one of the ways that I kind of noticed was that God tended to work inside of people. You know, we work to create in us a purified faith or to create a sense of humility, perhaps to deal with some bad behavior. You know, I think of the story by, I love C.S. Lewis, and if some of the people may have seen the movie The Voyage of the Dawn Treader or mm-hmm. read his book, and there's a story in there where Eustace, who's kind of this obnoxious kid and prideful and difficult kid who ends up becoming a dragon, and because of his greed, and ultimately he changes, realizing the awful person that he was prior to becoming the dragon. And Aslan, the type of Christ, takes him away and says, Eustace, you undress. And he tries getting himself out of the dragon clothes, and he can't. Every time he takes one off, there's another layer of skin. And finally, Aslan says, well, I'm going to have to do it. And C.S. Lewis talks about his long claws of Aslan the lion digging into him. And Eustace later says it was like he cut right to my heart. And then he peels away the dragon skin and brings out Eustace the human. Sometimes suffering is done at that level of surgery. I mean, it's really happening deep inside of us to transform us. Another way is to move us forward, to help us mature as Christians, to be more like Christ, to be conformed into his image. Also, it can happen on an outward level. Sometimes when we go through suffering, it lets the church and other people kind of step up and really show what the body of Christ can do. Like in the case of Dave and Teresa, when they lost their son, you know, the church just did wonderful things to help. And it was really a shining period for the church to really step out of their self-centered worlds and minister. Sometimes it gives people a ministry. Teresa, who, you know, soon started a grief ministry out of the result of losing her children, and then kind of, as she realized about her own sexual abuse, started ministering with that, and now does counseling for people, you know, that really came out of her own pain.
Absolutely, and that's reinvesting
and
your heart.
God uses our suffering to lead people to Christ. There was a story of some missionaries who worked for years and years in this African tribe and couldn't get anywhere, and the minister's wife and children all died within a very short period of time. They contracted some disease. And after several months, one of the tribe leader came to him and said, you know, you've been telling us about your religion and we still don't understand it, but we want to learn more because we like the way you bury your dead. You know, the hope that we as Christians have, you know, in losing and going through suffering can really be a testament to others. And then lastly, we talk about the book, The Upward Direction, you know, that God ultimately does it sometimes to give us dying grace. Gary talked about that in case of his wife, Debbie, that, you know, who died, and also to give us rewards in heaven. And ultimately, I really think all suffering, at least at some level, Rita, is designed to kind of help us glorify God. In John 9, the disciples asked, why is this guy blind, you know, and did he sin or his parents sin? And Jesus said, no, it's done so that God could be glorified in me. And then he, of course, heals the man, and he let Lazarus languor in a grave for 3 days and die, you know, in order to glorify himself. So suffering has a lot of different ways, and it can work in one or more of those directions. But whether we realize what the direction is or not, or the reason is or not, we can know God's up to something.
Sure.
You know, and he's doing something in us that only can be done from his masterful hands through allowing whatever into our life.
Talk about the 15 purposes of suffering that are allocated to those directions that you talk about.
Well, in the first inward direction, there's a few. One is a purified faith. Second is a humble heart. You know, Paul talked about he was given the opportunity of going to heaven, and yet God gave him a thorn in the flesh. God may use it as another reason to test our faithfulness, kind of coming out like gold. And then to deal with wayward children. I personally don't believe God, you know, is the first one to, you know, kind of zap us when we cross the line. But if certainly in my own life, I found if I don't heed his gentle reminders of turning my life back, sooner or later, he dares to discipline, to quote James Dobson.
Mm-hmm.
In the forward direction, that's where we talk about the maturing of us, that suffering is to mature us, make us complete, from the passage of James, make us like Christ, from the Romans, where it says to be conformed into his image, and to have a personalized faith, talking about Job, how he, in and of himself, could not have got much from the suffering, but as he encountered God in it, his faith, which was kind of learned through church, so to speak, became very real, as he talks about in chapter 42. And then outwardly, there was three that we talk about. In terms of building his kingdom, that's the evangelistic side of it, like I shared with the missionaries. A strong and caring church. In Corinthians 12, it talks about the fact that if one member suffers, who suffers? We all do,
mm-hmm.
Because we're all part of one body. And then to minister through us, 2 Corinthians chapter 1, that with the comfort we learn of God, we're able to minister to others. You know, we don't have to go through the same thing. I remember a pastor once telling me, he said, well, you know, I was single at the time, I was engaged, but he said, you know, you're really not going to be able to help married people until you're married, and you're really not going to be able to help parents until you have a parent. And I said, you know, as I think of what you're saying, Pastor, it scares me when the cocaine addicts come in and I would have had to do cocaine, and the homosexuals come in and I would have had to struggle with that. You know, we've all struggled with something and dealt with something. It certainly, having that personal experience gives you a level of insight that others don't have. And that's the value of it. But regardless of how we've learned, God and Christ came alongside us, we can learn to do that with others. And then the upward direction, the last one, there was a number we talk about, which is that God prepares us for a blessing. You know, I mentioned dying grace. We're given rewards for suffering that is talked about. And then to see his true character, Job said, you know, I thought I knew you, but now I know you. I see you for who you really are. And interestingly, if you read what God says to Job, it's one of my favorite parts of Job. You know, he's talking about how he waters places in the world that nobody will see, and these animals give birth in beautiful ways in places no one will ever see. And he talks about a dumb ostrich that, you know, nobody thinks is smart, but when it races, it's faster than everybody. And God's just talking about how extravagant he is, you know, and how lavish he is. And then in the last chapter of Job, it says he gives his daughters an inheritance. Well, nobody ever gave women back in those days money. I mean, you give it to your sons because your sons would help take care of you when you got old. You know, if you gave it to your daughters, it would go to their husbands' families. And yet Job lavishes money on his daughters and calls them these wonderful names. And I believe it's because he just realized, man, the God I met is that way. He's irrational and generous and extravagant, and so Job became that way. It, you know, really encountered God's character. And then last, you know, as I mentioned, to be glorified. So the 15 areas are kind of broken up, mm-hmm. you know, along those four dimensions.
Well, I think what you're saying about Job is he went from an intellectual knowing of God to an experiential knowing of God.
Oh, absolutely.
In suffering, I think, you know, just in our angst and in our railing at God or whatever we're going to do to get all that out, somewhere along the line, we connect to the heart of God. He gives us his heart because it was broken and shed for us. And that experiential knowing, coming to that place with him, is so powerful. And that's what changes us, I think, and can change our concept of God back to believing God is good, even in the midst of suffering.
Yeah. I say in the book, and this maybe be my one soundbite kind of a thing, suffering is applied theology, and that's exactly what you just said. It's where the real beliefs and stuff that's deep down inside us comes out. And it comes out in a way that ultimately we're going to have to grow it. And Job, as godly as he was, I mean, he was having sacrifices even in case his kids sinned. I mean, that's a religious man,
mm-hmm.
a godly man in that day, and yet he recognized how far he was from understanding God. And what a difference those last many years of his life must have been like.
Hmm. John, we're out of time for today. I could talk to you about this all day, but tell us how people can contact you if they have any questions.
Oh, I'd love that. Well, I'm an associate professor at Liberty, and so they can always email me at Liberty, and my email address is jcthomas, and then the number 2, don't write out 2, but the number, at liberty.edu. They can also access the book on Amazon or some of the other sites if they were interested in getting hold of the book.
Yeah, they can access that on my website, too, through the Amazon link there, too. So I want to let everybody know and make that available. We are so blessed and privileged to have had you on. I thank you so much and all the work you're doing. God bless you.
Oh, you're welcome, Rita. Thank you so much, and God bless your audience.
I had a big hole in my heart.
Thanks for joining me today. If you have a question or comment, or you'd like to be a guest on Heartline, I'd love to hear from you. You can contact me at siftedaswheat.com, on Facebook at Rita Schulte LPC, or Twitter at Heartline Pod. And remember, it's your heart. Keep it alive. Check the pulse.